Senate Committee on Rules. My apologies for being late. We are officially in subcommittee as we don't have a quorum, and we're here to hear Senate Bill 28. This is notice for the record that this bill will be heard, will be noticed tomorrow as well, but we will not likely have a hearing on it tomorrow. It's more likely we'll come back again on Wednesday. I know there are a number of folks in the room. We hope to get all of you on, so we would ask that you keep your testimony extremely brief, like we're going to start out in 3-minute increments, except, of course, there are a few exceptions. We have Mr. McCarthy here from Legislative Council. I also just wanted to give notice to the group that I have a meeting with the governor and leadership starting at 4:30. That's good news. That means that we're hopefully in negotiations about how to wrap up the session. So I will let Senator Farioli take over the gavel at that point in time. All right. Ms. Harris, what do we have before us? And Mr. McCarthy, come on up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're considering Senate Bill 1028 today. I'll let Legislative Council give us a better sense of the details, but Senate Bill 1028 establishes the public's right to use certain Class 1 waterways. It also clarifies the rights of riparian landowners and creates both a fund and a system for statewide management of Class 1 waterways and the access of the public to those waterways.
We are now officially in full committee. Mr. McCarthy, go ahead.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Brendan McCarthy with Legislative Council's office. I'm at your disposal to some extent. Don't know exactly where you'd like me to begin, but...
Briefly, I'd like to do a walkthrough of the bill itself and then walk through the Dash 1 amendments, please. Unless it's easier to kind of do those in coordination.
Well, the Dash 1 amendments basically reprint the bill.
Okay.
So it may be easier to just go through. Well, I think it should go through the bill and then address the Dash 1s.
Okay.
The overall concept behind the what we're attempting to do with this bill was to try to put some codification on what's generally understood as the flow to easement or public use doctrine of Oregon's rivers, and to establish a means and method whereby conflict on the rivers could be resolved. So the bill itself, as printed, is a little bit rough, and there are some points in it which it's a little bit herky-jerky. I think a lot of those things have been improved upon in the Dash 1s. Section 1 gives the authority to the State Land Board, or directs the State Land Board, to adopt a statewide management plan to govern Class 1 waterways, govern the use of Class 1 waterways. The goal there is that's the first large piece that we're looking at is a management plan for all waterways which meet certain tests of floatability. We've defined Class 1 waterways in Section 4 to mean any segment of a floatable natural tidal or non-tidal waterway and its banks. And bank means all the way up to the line of ordinary high water. So what we're carving out there from the get-go is a discussion of recreational use all the way up to the high water line, which recreational use is also defined to mean participation in water-dependent activities and incidental uses connected with those activities. We're talking about a broad section of activities. So the hope is that if we have a management plan that is adopted, there could be certain rivers where the plan says fishing is allowed, swimming is allowed, boating is allowed. There could be a section of a river that says swimming is not allowed, only fishing is allowed. There could be different uses, limited or excluded, and conditions put on those uses. Also important in Section 1 is the fact that the State Land Board is given the authority to delegate the responsibility for developing the plan to another department. Section 2 directs the board to adopt a or to appoint a an advisory committee and specifies the duties and membership of the committee. The concept there is that issues would come up regarding use of rivers, regarding conflict on particular rivers and reaches and stretches and segments of particular rivers, and that in order to modify and amend the statewide management plan, it would be helpful to have a forum where those concerns could be reviewed, heard, discussed, and then forwarded on to the State Land Board for inclusion into the statewide management plan. Section 4 of the bill is a definitional section. Again, I think while all of the definitions are important, we should probably highlight Class 1 and Class 2 waterway. And floatable is important because we floatable and then again the broad definition of recreational use. Section 5 is really the guts and the meat of recreational use itself. We set out the first rule, which is a person may make recreational use of any waterway, Class 1 or Class 2. That's the broad rule. Then the rest of the section provides conditions on that rule. So subsection 2, we say you can't use a Class 2 waterway unless you receive express permission from the landowner. If it's a small stream, not generally floatable, it's could be ephemeral, we want people going and getting permission before they use it. Subsection 3, hydroelectric facilities. We've given the authority for owners of those facilities to regulate the use in and around those facilities. I think that's important for general safety concerns. Subsection 4, we go back and we reference the statewide management plan. So a person may not use a Class 1 waterway if the use has been otherwise conditioned or restricted by the plan. And then going down to subsection 6, a person may not use a waterway for recreational use that involves a boat unless the person does one of three things: holds a valid certificate of number, which would be a normal, if you had a normal motorized boat, you'd have a certificate of number. Paragraph B, holds a valid non-motorized boat certificate of number. That's a new thing that we're thinking about in this bill. It's it would be, I have a drift boat, I normally don't have a motor on it, but occasionally I might want to have a motor on it at some point in time in the future. I could go ahead and get a certificate of number for my non-motorized boat. When I'm using that non-motorized boat on a Class 1 waterway, that would be, because I'd have a number on the bow, that would be fine. The whole goal here is to have identifying features on all people that are using boats on a waterway, so that if there's conflict with the landowner, the person can say, I saw boat, you know, number N1257 going past my property, and they were, you know, shooting ducks out of season or building a campfire or whatever. And so there's some identifying feature. The last piece is also a new piece, which is what we've referred to in the introduced bill as a recreational use registration. The concept there is that we would have a transferable permit of some kind. So if I had five kayaks, I would apply, get a transferable recreational use permit. It would have some sort of identifying number, and I would be required to attach it somehow to either my life jacket or my boat in some fashion that was visible. And I could then go ahead and use my kayak down this Class 1 waterway. If the next weekend I wanted to use my drift boat, I could take my transferable permit and go ahead and use my drift boat. It gives people a little flexibility if they have multiple non-motorized boats. Section 6, we talk about travel on property adjacent to waterways. That would be upland travel, because there may be situations where someone gets on a Class 1 waterway and needs to exit the waterway in an area that is bounded by private property on both sides, we've said in order to portage, or if you've got an emergency situation, maybe you've damaged your boat some way that you can't continue, or maybe you're having a medical emergency, there may be a need to cross private property. We've restricted people to the most direct and least intrusive fashion and told them to take reasonable steps in order to not make any damage, and if they do, to take reasonable steps to repair that damage. We've provided a defense to criminal trespass, and for someone who does trespass, you know, by the actual word of the law, they would be committing a trespass. We provided a defense for them if they do follow the least intrusive path, take reasonable steps to avoid damage, and take reasonable steps to repair the damage if they do cause damage. And then we've made those people liable for actual damage. So if someone carries a boat out of a river, they damage a fence, in carrying the boat out, we would expect that the river user would be liable for that damage. Section 7 and 8 are general protections for riparian landowners. We talk about people not being able to acquire prescriptive easements for their use of a waterway. We talk about riparian landowners not being liable for damage to natural resources caused by users of the river, and not liable in contract or tort for personal injury, death, or property damage. So if someone's using a Class 1 waterway or Class 2 waterway on someone's property, they would not be liable in contract or tort. I think that's important to point out. I know that's been a flashpoint in the past, and it is in the bill. Section 9, and this is one area that's going to diverge in the dash ones. We direct the State Marine Board to adopt a program for regulation of recreational use, and this is where we have the direction to issue this transferable permit I spoke about previously. We allow them to designate agents. We're hopefully, in drafting this, we were thinking that it would be, in a sense, similar to any other fishing permit or the snow park pass permit or whatnot. There could be agents anywhere who would be willing to issue these transferable permits, pay an agent fee. But if you were to go out on a Saturday and you didn't have a permit with you, you could swing by, you know, the old bait shop and pick up a transferable permit and go forth and use the river legitimately. We're also, as part of the program, we recognize that some of the conflict is a result of lack of education and information. Hopefully with this program, we're going to have the State Marine Board doing some dissemination of educational materials. Also, there's an issue with lack of facilities. Part of the conflict coming from people's behavior on the banks of the rivers. So hopefully there will be money coming in from the permits, the new permits, to pay for facilities at boat entry points and exit points. Section 10 is administrative, creating a sub-account in the Marine Board's main account for depositing of monies from the new permits. Section 12 is the new non-motorized permit or new non-motorized boat certificate of number section. It's very similar to the standard motorized certificate of number section. We have a per foot $2 per foot fee for boats. And I think the rest of the bill can probably go without explanation. It's giving authority to the State Land Board and to parks and to agreements with the State Land Board. There is a penalty provision in Section 18 for violating the management plan or any provision of the Act. And Sections 19 and 20 are some general applicability sections, and that is about it. The dash ones. Any questions?
Questions from the committee? None.
Okay. Moving on. The dash ones, we've done some reorganization. The definitional sections now appear at the front. The role of the State Land Board has generally been prioritized. So you'll see that Section 2 is remarkably the same as Section 1 of the bill. There has been a modification to the definition of Class 1 waterway. It's now a segment of a free-flowing, which would then eliminate lakes. Floatable natural waterway, whether tidal or non-tidal, that's located wholly within the state. There was some concern about regulation on the Columbia and the Snake, where it forms the border of the state between Idaho and Washington. Located wholly within the state should take care of that issue. Therefore, folks who were, say, windsurfing in the gorge would not need to get a transferable permit for their sailboard or kiteboard. We have made, a change to the definition of floatable to track language from court cases that talk about having the capacity in terms of length, width, and depth necessary to enable a boat to make successful progress through a waterway at any time. I think that's important to let that language track with what the court has determined would be floatable. We have made some changes in Section 4, the dash ones, which would have been Section 5 of the bill. We have, importantly, I think, changed recreational use of a Class 1 waterway may be conditioned, limited, or restricted or excluded by federal law or rules of a federal agency with management authority over the waterway. That's in Section 4, Sub 4, Paragraph C. And that's important where we may have a Class 1 waterway traveling through, coursing through otherwise federally owned land. There may be a situation where there may be additional federal regulations that someone may need to comply with, such as camping, fires would be a good one. And so without addressing the question of whether that waterway is navigable, there may be some interaction between state regulation and federal regulation, and that is important to highlight. The other thing important to highlight is in subsection 6, where we've put in a person may not use a boat in conjunction with recreational use of a waterway. We've allowed people who would otherwise be paying a federal fee. So if there were a federal area on the Deschutes or the Rogue where there was a federal permit, we're not going to require double permitting. If that fee is paid and they've got a federal permit, we see no need to require another state permit in addition. We have changed the language in Section 5 relating to the trespass. There was some concern that the most direct and least intrusive path may not always be the safest path, and it may require people to use a little bit of reasonableness, so we put in another reasonable requirement, the most reasonably direct and least intrusive path. Should allow some freedom in the person who is portaging to say, well, the most direct path has to go through that gigantic bear trap, and that's not really, I can head there, but I can skirt that and it'll be fine. Other points of difference between the bill and the dash ones, we now have a we don't call it a recreational use permit any longer. It is now referred to as a transferable non-motorized boat permit, which indicates that it is what it is. It's transferable, and it's for non-motorized boats. The account that monies went into was controlled previously by the State Marine Board. It's now continuously appropriated to the State Land Board. And other than that, I think that the differences are minor. Any questions?
Questions from the panel? The chair has questions. Mr. McCarthy, you talked about the codification of floatage. What's the current status of floatage law in Oregon? Where do we look to in the Oregon Revised Statutes to get definitions and find out where that is in fact described so that the public understands what the floatage rights are?
Mr. Chair, that's not codified currently.
Okay. So part of the thrust of this would in fact be to put definitions to floatage and to actually create some statutory understanding about what floatage is and who may exercise those rights. Currently, the definition of floatage is, I guess, whatever people want it to be. Would that be somewhat accurate?
Mr. Chair, there is a body of law, common law, behind the floatage easement and public use doctrine. We have tried with this to use those points that we can find for agreement and bring them in for codification such that our floatable definition is not, we believe, too far from what is commonly understood as floatable.
Okay. You mentioned that one of the objectives of Senate Bill 1028 is to reduce conflicts between landowners and recreationists. Currently, is there any state agency charged under state statute with reducing conflict between recreationists and landowners in the river corridors?
Mr. Chair, to my knowledge, no. There's no single state agency charged with reducing conflict. Obviously, law enforcement, local law enforcement on various occasions. State Marine Board is obviously involved to some extent in certain places, but perhaps parks and other places, but I don't want to speak for them. But
they tend,
no single agency.
The law enforcement personnel tend to be conflict historians that come and take reports. Does the Dash 1 amendment, how does it treat the Attorney General's most recent opinion and most recent thinking about floatage and recreation access of waterways in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, I have read the Attorney General's opinion. I would hate to speak for the Attorney General. My reading of the Attorney General's opinion was that it was until we get to questions of upland access, fairly broadly permissive toward recreational use as being under the general public use, they referred to it as the public use doctrine. I think that this bill dovetails fairly neatly with that opinion, in that we are not seeking to enlarge that opinion or even shrink it. Hopefully we're trying to get on the same page as the Attorney General's opinion with this bill. And obviously I think that would be a point of discussion as time moves on, and I certainly would look forward to working with this committee in getting amendments that would make sure that does happen.
Okay, so the draft Dash 1 codifies floatage, reduces conflicts between landowners and recreationists, and incorporates the Attorney General's most recent thinking on the issue, in my opinion. So, what I'd like to do is, if any of the senator, question?
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry I missed the first part of your presentation, so I may be asking you something that you already said. But I would like you to specify, I guess, as succinctly as possible, to what extent would Senate Bill 1028 under these Dash 1 amendments reduce public access to a river that has been found to be navigable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, when you say a river that has been found to be navigable, are you speaking about a river that has been adjudicated as navigable by a court of competent jurisdiction, or are you talking about a river that has been determined navigable by the state land board? Or
I'm not sure if you're making a distinction pertaining to the John Day.
Well, the John Day would be one river that has undergone a navigability study, but there's not been a formal determination of navigability by the state land board.
Okay.
I'd be more referring to, say, the lower 37.5 miles of the Sandy,
well,
or segments of the Mackenzie or the Chetco that have.
I'll let you pick any river you want, and whether there's been a navigability finding or determination or not. And I just want to know to what extent this bill would impact public access.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, we have attempted to ensure that any public access allowed by a finding of navigability by either a court of competent jurisdiction or by the state land board or by some sort of other method is taken care of in section, I think, 4 of the Dash 1 amendments, subsection 5, and that would be unless allowed pursuant to the statewide management plan or unless the Class 1 waterway has been deemed navigable by the state land board or a court order of court of competent jurisdiction or by the legislative assembly, person may not use the Class 1 waterway for the following purposes.
And arguably those uses might be allowed currently for a river that's found to have been navigable.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, that's correct. That those uses would be generally be allowed because of state ownership of those lands.
I see. Okay. Just to follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
On page 2 of the bill, near the top, you have the definition of floatable. And I was wondering if you could just explain on line 7, it says at any time, in other words, means the capacity in terms of length, width, and depth necessary to enable a boat to make successful progress to a waterway at any time, regardless of the presence of shallow rapids. Does that at any time include times of drought where there just may not be sufficient water?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I think that also has to be read with the capacity word, which I think should it would mean that rivers which occasionally may be in times of drought unpassable may certainly be considered floatable. Does that answer your question?
Yes, although I'm not sure how that's consistent with the language. What do the words at any time mean then?
I think that's an attempt, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, to ensure that the grouping of possible rivers is fairly large, that if those conditions exist at any time, then it is floatable. So that could be under periods of high water, winter flows, and impassable on summer flows.
I see it. I see. Okay.
Again, that may be an issue that we need to refine a little bit further. And Senator Ringo, that language has undergone a little bit of review from the Department of Justice and has been looked at in the context of cases relating to, well, mostly the log drive cases from 100 years ago. But it's an attempt to model the codification language after what the court has given us as far as the public use stuff.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Further questions?
No, I'll stop right there.
Senator?
Thank you very much, Brendan. I guess the committee would appreciate your presence, at least if not in person in the committee, tele-video. Just keep your eye on the hearing, and if we need your counsel to answer questions, hope you'll remain on call for us.
I would be happy to do so. Mm-hmm. I'll be on the side for a little while. And
okay.
If not, I'll sneak back to my office.
Thank you. I'd like to call Randall Edwards. We're happy to have the state treasurer here, and Mr. Edwards, I'd just like to ask you to recap for the record what has interested you in the issue of Senate Bill 1028 and the desire to come to some resolution on conflict between river landowners and river recreational users.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, state treasurer of Oregon, and also a land board member. I'm here because it's time to find a statewide solution to a challenge that we've been having as a land board. But more importantly, I think it's time for the state to recognize that we have got to come up with a better solution than we have currently on the books to address the problem of conflicts on our rivers. That simply is that finding a balance between allowing access, allowing people to recreate on our rivers, as well as respecting private property. And I believe Senate Bill 1028 strikes that balance. And I want to thank the chair and vice chair for introducing this bill, because it's time that we have this discussion to find a solution statewide and move forward. The problem I see right now, and the reason I'm so adamant about finding a statewide solution, is that the navigability process that we have in law today is serving nobody. Let me repeat that. The navigability process we have today is serving nobody. It's slow, it's piecemeal, it's litigious, and in the end, should we find a river navigable where we assert state title, then we have the situation of how do you manage that river? And I know Senator Ringo just had a question about whether or not this bill limits access or use on a river under navigability. I can say that when we determined navigability on the Sandy River, we did put limitations on camping, fire, open fires, if you will. So we can restrict, even when a river is determined navigable, recreational uses on those rivers. But the point I'm here today to ask for your consideration is, Let's look at a statewide solution. If we don't find a statewide solution, and I know there are a lot of people in this room who maybe don't understand why we're coming to this point today, but I can tell you that we continue to go down the path. If we don't pass Senate Bill 1028 or some iteration of 1028, we'll continue to have the fallback of navigability determinations, which again have been very slow in determining navigability. We as a state have to go back and look at the time of statehood to determine whether or not a river was navigable or potentially navigable at that time period. Landowners all of a sudden get a notice from the state land board saying, by the way, that property that you'd had title on, potentially on the bank or in the river, may not have been yours. And in fact, navigability is a power given to the states to override all property rights to say that was the public's. And so we have a problem with public understanding of why it is that the state, 100 plus years later, is coming to them to say the public has ownership of this bed and bank should we find navigability. I think there's lots of things in this bill, and you're probably going to hear from a lot of people about what they don't like about this bill. But I think you should challenge those people to ask, if we don't do this, then what do we do? What's the solution? There are fees in this bill. I believe that if you're looking for comprehensive management, we need to find some mechanism to help enforce, monitor, educate, and resources need to be put to that. We don't have that currently. We give landowners protections they don't have today. We indemnify them from, and under this bill, we would indemnify them from liability should somebody get hurt on their property. Assuming that happened on their property, they are not protected from liability. This bill would do that. It also provides some balance about what kind of recreational activities can occur on this on these rivers. And again, as the land board, as a land board member speaking not only for myself but the entire land board, we feel it's time to find an alternative to the navigability process. I think what's added some additional reasoning to find a statewide solution is the Department of Justice's opinion, the Attorney General's opinion, about what are the implied rights with the water. I'm not a water expert. I know my attorney, the Attorney General office, is here to answer any questions about their opinion sitting next to me. But the fact is, with the water come certain rights, and their opinion was, based on case law, those rights expand to the bed and the bank of rivers throughout Oregon, and potentially above the high water mark, which I know will raise a lot of eyebrows, but the point here is, with these waterways, the public has the ability to recreate, to have, they have implied rights, and this bill strikes that balance between those rights, the rights of the landowner, and again, some long-term perspective of trying to better manage the rivers and reduce the conflicts that continue to occur on our rivers in the state. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the time.
Questions from the committee? You've had discussions with the other members of the State Land Board and have characterized the fact that they are a little bit frustrated with this process as well. I wonder if you could just share with the committee what kind of discussions you've had.
Sure. Again, Mr. Chair, I when I got on the land board a little over 4 years ago, I was confronted with a navigability determination on the Sandy River. And for the record, I did not support that determination, although the staff had come up with rationale for asserting title on that river. And I took that as a personal challenge to try to see, is there an alternative to this process? Landowners were coming to these hearings saying, you know, don't take my land. They were concerned about what would happen with the public once they got on the river. They felt like this would somehow entice more public use. The fact is, navigability has had not changed that dynamic. And in fact, I would submit that because we've put some restrictions on types of uses, some landowners have been very appreciative of what's happened as a result of navigability. But the land board itself has had many discussions about the rivers that are being asked to be petitioned and looked at, the John Day being the most recent one, whereby we have said on the record many times in our land board meetings that the process we have today, again, as I just characterized it, is slow, it's piecemeal, and it takes a great deal of time, and potentially you could see and we have seen litigation in the past over a decision in navigability. The public who wants access is frustrated. The landowners are frustrated. We're frustrated. It's time to find a solution that eases those frustrations and begins to try to find a long-term solution. I think that's in Senate Bill 1028.
I have a question for your counsel. I'd like to ask the legal counsels to expand on the issues. The treasurer testified to the issue of implied rights and indicated that we heard from legal counsel, Mr. McCarthy, that there are no statutory or codified rights of floatage. What did you find relative to the implied rights? You could just discuss that a little bit.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Lori Bensel. I'm a senior assistant attorney general in the Natural Resources Section of General Counsel of the Department of Justice. One of my primary clients is the State Land Board for Lands Issues. Senator, the opinion addressed two main sources for public rights to use waterways for recreational purposes. And actually, the opinion was broader than recreational use, but for this conversation, I'll focus on recreational use. The first is state ownership of all tidally influenced or tidally navigable waterways in the state of Oregon. And that ownership exists whether or not there has been a declaration or determination of ownership by the State Land Board or by a court. We reviewed the test for tidal influence, which is very simple. We spent a good deal of time discussing the test of tidal navigability. And I would note that, what was said in the opinion regarding tidal navigability was recently supported by the Court of Appeals in the Northwest Steelheaders opinion that was issued last week. We went through that test because we knew we were going to be saying that members of the public may exercise all the rights of the public on state-owned waterways without waiting for the land board to name specific rivers. So we wanted to be clear about what we believe the test was so that the public could read the opinion and perhaps for themselves make a determination about whether they were willing to risk trespassing on private land if they, by themselves, making a determination about state ownership. We also commented that state ownership of waterways has a very special character, unlike the ownership of many other lands in the state of Oregon. And because of that, state government cannot take measures that would substantially impair the public's rights to use state-owned waterways. That does not mean they can't manage them, but public rights need to be facilitated and balanced and managed. The second part of the opinion focused on what the department decided to call the doctrine of public use. Many members of the public refer to that as the floatage easement, but in the research for the department, we felt that that was too restrictive a term. It brought a connotation to mind that was not strictly applicable to the doctrine. That doctrine is based on Oregon Supreme Court opinions issued between 1869 and 1936 and actually has its roots back in the English common law. There have not been any court opinions that we could locate since 1936 where the court relied on the doctrine of public use. But the Department of Justice has used that legal principle many times since 1936 to advise its clients. We looked both at what we felt was clear statements by the court about what was included by that doctrine, and then also took the step further of saying the kinds of uses that we believe a modern court would confirm if given an opportunity today. We looked at what we considered the lead case for the test, which is the Gilliam's test, and is reflected in the definition of floatability in both the introduced version and in the Dash 1 amendments. That case, the court specifically said it was trying to take a step back and look overall at the doctrine and develop a general test that would be equally applicable for all kinds of uses. Then we also looked at if a river is floatable, then what kind of uses were authorized under the doctrine. We divided it up between lands located below the ordinary low water line and lands located above the ordinary high water line and lands above the ordinary high water line. Below the line, a broad range of water-dependent uses and uses that are incidental to those uses was allowed by the court. Everything from massive log drives that destroyed the creeks was allowed by the court. So certainly high-impact uses was allowed. All the way down to much more less impactful types of uses, there is one case that discusses the use of pleasure boats and pleasure fishing. From that, we also looked at the general principles announced in that case law, things such as that users must use reasonable and prudent care in their use of the waterways, and that both the private landowners and the users must both recognize that they both have rights to the waterway and should not unnecessarily interfere with each other's use. There were some additional basic principles, but I won't emphasize them here. Based on that, we then took the next step, which was to try and review what kinds of uses would be allowed, and that's where we came up with water-dependent uses and uses that are incidental thereto. We predict that a modern court would uphold that scope of use if presented with the issues. In the third section, we return to the question of whether or not the public can exercise its rights without waiting for land board decisions about title navigability or without waiting for codification of these rights, and conclude that, in fact, the public can exercise these rights at this time without further action by the legislature or an administrative agency. But we did caution that any individual using the waterway would need to ask themselves whether they believe and were willing to risk that either the waterway was state-owned because it's tidally influenced or tidally navigable, or that it met the general test stated in Gilliam's, the floatability question. If it turned out they were wrong, they would be on their own and subject to potential liability. There are I'll leave it with that as far as the scope of the uses. Based on that, as a general statement, the introduced version of the bill is in many respects consistent. The management planning is consistent. The registration, licensing, collecting fees is consistent. Splitting management responsibilities between the land board and the marine board is consistent, with one caveat that because the land board is in charge of the land under a whole set of programs relating to raising money for the common schools and other purposes, it is important to have the land board play an important role, unless you intend to go in and modify those other programs. And liability protection for landowners is increased, but still reasonably consistent with the opinion. Liability exposure for users is increased, particularly for strict liability above the line of ordinary high water line. And so that would be one inconsistency. There are several differences between the introduced version and the Dash 1 version, which I have only had the Dash 1 version for a little over an hour, but it looks like those are being worked through. There's definitely a few tweaks still left to do, and I won't comment completely on how consistent all of that is. I think probably one of the most important inconsistencies so far is that the bill does not include the basic premise of users needing to use reasonable and prudent care, and that both landowners and users being held to a standard of not unnecessarily interfering with each other. I also realize I haven't mentioned upland use. For that, we reached the conclusion that for those waterways that are floatable, that we started from with the premise of saying that waterway use would be, use above ordinary high would be the same as allowed below ordinary low, but with one very important addition, that the use needed to be necessary in order to accommodate the use of the waterway below ordinary high. But it isn't so restrictive as to be limited to emergency use and portaging of, and particularly portaging of a boat. So the bill is particularly inconsistent for upland uses. Those are the highlights.
Okay. You did touch on the issue that I would like some clarification on, the issue of water-dependent uses and incidental uses. So I think the Attorney General's opinion does try to define what water dependent means. Maybe you could help me understand it.
Mr. Chair, I think water dependent is things that require water in order for the activity to occur. Swimming requires water. Picnicking does not. Any kind of boating is going to require water. Hiking, simply to hike, does not. walking while fishing does. Providing guiding services for people who want to raft the river does. The incidental uses then says, well, if you have a primary use that is water dependent, what is really go hand in hand with that use? So some examples may be you are rafting a stretch of the river that is 40 miles long between two public access points. A reasonable person doesn't raft that in one day. Let's make that presumption. So an incidental use would include camping. You or perhaps Senator Ringo had raised the question about, actually I believe it was Senator Ringo, had raised the question about the meaning of at any time in the definition of floatability. I think that is one place where I would add a comment to what Mr. McCarthy said, which is where state ownership is involved. Let me back up. The test of floatability will be slightly broader, therefore more inclusive than tidally influenced and tidal navigability. There will be some locations where a waterway is floatable, but not state-owned. In that context, whether or not a waterway is floatable, I admit when I had looked at any time, Mr. McCarthy referred to the fact that I had looked at this issue, at any time, the case law regarding the doctrine of public use does carry with it an idea that a waterway may have water flowing in it and be floatable at one point, but in August it has dried up and you couldn't get a toy sailboat in it. At that point, public use would not be allowed during that period.
Okay, the question that occurred to me is the incidental use. You mentioned camping and used an example of two, a put in and take out site 40 miles apart. Would people be in this scenario, would they be camping above or below the ordinary high water mark?
Mr. Chair, that comment is based on use below ordinary high.
Okay. So one of the mechanisms or one of the needs to put floatage in some sort of statute is to put these definitions in statute with greater clarity than the Attorney General's opinion. Upon who is the Attorney General's opinion binding?
To the extent that on a day-to-day basis I advise the land board, my advice will take into account the legal opinion of the Attorney General as stated in the Attorney General's opinion. Mm-hmm. To the extent that that is specific advice on a specific issue, there are some circumstances where I suppose a person could call that binding on the state land board. Often my job is about evaluating pros and cons and risk analysis. And so in many, many contexts, my advice is not exactly binding.
The reason I ask the question is that we also in the legislature have legal counsel, and they often offer us opinions. But my understanding is with the assistant attorney generals working for specific agencies, their advice is binding to that agency or other state agencies. The AG's opinions primarily are for the executive branch in conducting its business. They may not be binding to the general public. That was the point I was trying to get at. I have a couple questions for Mr. Edwards, and then we'll turn it over to the general public. You touched on, in your testimony, the idea that we need a statewide solution. Why isn't a river-by-river solution I mean, that's what's happening now. Lots of folks think it's working just fine. And what's wrong with maintaining the system that gives you a decision on a river-by-river basis?
Mr. Chair, and this is my personal opinion, that navigability is a very powerful law, if you will, or power that the state has. And my experience with it to date has been there's a lot of confusion about why is the state here? I mean, why are we at this river, looking at this river now, some hundred and some years later, to determine whether the public had ownership to this river that is the bed and the bank, not the water, the bed and the bank. And I would submit that my personal experience is this process doesn't work very well. It takes years for us to get through a determination of navigability, potentially. I know there's some in this room who are frustrated how slow we've been on a number of rivers. I would submit that the landowners that I've worked with on this issue are equally frustrated, and they have a varying opinion about whether or not, again, they will confront us whether or not this is a navigable waterway and dispute the facts that end up being put together to determine navigability. The public policy question before you in the end, though, is Oregon has a population that recreates. Oregon has a population of landowners. There is growing pressure on these waterways to find a way to mitigate conflict. And we've heard stories from both sides of recreationists going down a river, anchoring in a river, being confronted by a landowner who has pulled a gun on them. And again, this is an example. Then we've heard the equally distraught stories of people coming along rivers who trash private property. There's a lot for both sides to argue we've got a problem. Navigability doesn't necessarily end that problem. And that's where I think if we can get to a longer-term statewide solution, I really make this this view of the bill much like the beach bill, to the extent that you have got, you're not asserting title here. You're asserting who has rights in this case to the water and the bed and the bank, and who can then also be told what are the limits to that. I think law enforcement, we haven't talked at all about law enforcement. In fact, a couple of rivers for navigability have been brought to us by DAs who, quite frankly, don't know how to enforce this conflict or whose side's right. I think that's, again, where we're trying to find some codification, some clarification, trying to bring some longer-term perspective statewide on these rivers. Because, as the Attorney General's office just described, whether or not we've determined navigability at this point, unless it's codified in law, some floatage rights that this bill would do, you, the individual, have to determine whether or not you're right. And if you're wrong, you're liable. And I think this is where your job is right now, is to come up with a statewide solution to these rivers, because the Department of Justice certainly, in my opinion, has just opened the door that we collectively, policymakers, executive branch, have some responsibility in trying to help the public better understand what should be taking place on these rivers, and that's what Senate Bill 1028 does.
I want to thank you and commend you for undertaking this issue. I think most people will realize that have looked at this issue that your questioning of the process on the Sandy catalyzed a rethinking of the whole question of the management of recreation in the river corridor, and whether or not just a determination of navigability resolves some of the questions and the conflicts. And I really appreciate the fact that you've been willing to undertake this issue. It's not one that's likely to win friends and influence people. You may have noticed.
Well, it's been quite an experience, Mr. Chair, and I guess if, you always hear about third rails in politics. I'm not sure if you, again, in this room, you're going to hear a lot of people who do not like aspects of this bill. But I think if you step back and ask the question, if not this, what? Most people, I would submit, do not like the current process that we have. We've got to find a solution. your leadership and Senator Brown's are very much also appreciated, because this issue has to find a solution, and you're starting to make history here. I really think this is the long-term solution for the state of Oregon, and one that we could all look back and say we did the right thing and started moving this ball forward. Thank you.
Further questions?
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair. I mean, Senator Atkinson's not here, but he said that he is frequently driven away at gunpoint when he's on rivers. So I don't just want to put that in the mix.
Isn't that
for him, that's
something more to do with Senator Atkinson's personality? Maybe the fishing garb he chooses to wear.
Mr. Chair, just another question, though. What is likely to happen on the navigability decision on the John Day if this bill doesn't pass?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I don't know yet. I think we're, as a land board, holding tight to see what the legislature does. But again, they're two sort of independent decisions. We've committed that we would be making a determination in June at our next land board meeting. So my personal hope is that we can get this bill through and show that we don't, on a statewide basis, we have a need that we need to address.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
just to follow up on that, do you believe that the land board has a legal obligation to reach a navigability finding based on the recommendations presented to it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, we have discretion in these decisions. I don't know if we have the legal obligation. And I'm turning to my lawyer who...
Perhaps you'd like to have this conversation in the hallway and then come back.
Again, my interest in this bill, pure and simple, whether we had the John Day within our reach here, if you will, by June, is really to look at this statewide. As you recall, for that record, a similar bill was looked at for the John Day, a management plan. We got it out of the Senate. It was passed by largely in the Senate. Got it to the House, got it out of committee. It didn't get to the floor in time. We believe we had the support. And that was a very similar model for the John Day. So I think we've set the precedent here of trying to find an alternative. Many in this room have been involved in trying to find that solution. Not everybody likes everything, but I think, again, we've tried to strike a balance here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last question. Why do you think compromise has been so difficult to arrive at in this question?
That's for my attorney to answer, right? Well, I think, Mr. Chair, part of it has been... one thing over the last 4 years I could say is there's been a greater level of education and at least interest. There's been more media attention about the rivers that we're determining navigable, if you will. And I guess there seems to maybe potentially before that time there wasn't the publicity, if you will, of these determinations. I guess I've taken it upon myself as has the land board, to try to push to get another alternative, because we sit in this seat, the three of us sit in a seat where we are in this process, which, again, from my perspective, isn't serving anyone, in which case it's really having this hearing today. Again, the folks in the audience, as well as those who are going to see this on TV or audio, will, I think, better understand sort of the challenge we're facing as a state on these rivers. The Department of Justice has now added another dimension to this debate. I think it's time that we step up and try to find a long-term solution. And again, I commend you and Senator Brown for putting this forward, because this is the beginning of the debate we need to have to find a different alternative.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Colleagues, what we'll do now is we'll call groups of three from the list of witnesses, and then we'll learn why it is that recreations hate this bill, and later we'll learn why landowners hate this bill. Should we please hear from first from Gary Benson, Art Israelson, and Dwayne Duran. And if you'll notice, I'll just share this with the entire audience. We have two full pages of witnesses signed up to testify. The chair, before she left, asked that we try to come to the nub of the issue within 3 minutes, and if possible, please try not to repeat testimony that may have been heard on specific issues by another witness, so that what we're trying to do here is get all of your comments on the record, and repetition is not necessarily change the weight of the issue. It would be good if we could get everybody an opportunity to speak. Mr. Benson, you are first.
Thank you, Chairman Ferrioli. My name is Gary Benson. I'm the volunteer co-president and legislative director for the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. Our organization has never been enamored with the navigability study process for all of the reasons already stated. We've been here before and stated that our preference has been to try to resolve this in a legislative process. And we do feel, however, that that legislation has to be in line with the AG's opinion. We do not view the current bill, the 1028, as the appropriate solution, and we've got some concerns with it that I wanted to enumerate. First of all, charging new fees for the use of Oregon rivers we feel is totally inappropriate, no matter what you call it. I noticed from the earlier testimony they're calling it something different, but nevertheless, it's a use fee. And we all know what the Admissions Act says about imposing taxes on use of rivers. Secondly, the proposed non-motorized boat fee we feel is out of line with the scope of the problem. We need the clarity of law. We don't need millions of dollars in it. We think it would amount to several millions of dollars to solve the river conflict. We're opposed to the Waterways Advisory Committee, particularly because it has inequitable representation in our view. I noticed from the Dash 1 amendments there are now only two riparian landowners where there were three before. However, when you include the tribal representatives, who we view as landowners, you still have landowners three, recreationalists two. Classifying the Matolius River as a Class 2 waterway just doesn't pass the straight face test. I mean, it's just totally out of line, and I think probably everybody in this room would probably agree with that. Somebody mentioned to me earlier today that they thought there was a Measure 37 exemption in the Dash 1 amendments. I didn't see it, but in any event, I think that issue needs to be dealt with. It's well understood that Measure 37 would not affect navigability determinations, but with this legislation where the state would not be asserting title, there could be some concerns there. Again, we support a legislative solution that codifies the AG's opinion, but we can't support this bill in its present form. I would say that we could support an interim committee that thoroughly examines what public services that might be needed for recreationalists and landowners and determine the scope of the needs. I think this to me smacks of a sort of ready-shoot-aim approach where we're going to establish fees, but we really don't know how much money we need, and we really don't know the extent of the problem. But we think after those questions are answered, then we could talk about possible funding sources. And I would remind those here that the John Day bill from the last session, which proposed a sort of a demonstration project with a management plan, did not include fees, as I recall. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Israelson?
My name is Art Israelson. I'm the River Access Director for the Northwest Steelheaders. I'm also a volunteer. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, as you probably heard last week, the State Court of Appeals decided that the John Day case said that the river was navigable in two places, and that was for tidal navigability. The question comes up frequently from landowners, the state is taking my land. One of the things that the Court of Appeals said was that the land in both cases on the river was patented, but it did not include the river bank to bank, even though the landowners owned both sides of the land. but the land below the high water mark was not included. Another question that just came up recently was, why don't we do this river by river under the navigability system? The Division of State Lands came out about 5 or 6 years ago with a list of possible navigable rivers in the state of Oregon. It had 334 rivers on it. The state says that they can only do about one river a year. This leaves a lot of people in a lurch trying to figure out, whether they're landowners or recreationists, what rights they have to be where. I have a letter in the packet that I'm going to leave with you from the Linn County Board of Commissioners. On Thomas Creek in Linn County over by Sio last summer, four people were arrested for trespass. They got to the river by way of a county bridge, county right-of-way, county parking lot, and were in front of a neighboring piece of property. The commissioner says that they don't have the money to prosecute these cases. My question is, why did they even bring charges against the person? They brought the people into court in the Justice of the Peace Court, which is not a possibility. It has to go to the district court because it was a criminal charge. This happened in July. There are still charges pending in that county on this particular trespass. We have another letter here included that has an incident on the Pistol River where a landowner had barbed wire stretched across the river and was ordered to remove it and didn't. And I'm aware of one in Klamath County right now where there's a great stretch of barbed wire runs down a considerable amount of the river, and it's still there. We had a state motto a couple years ago: we do things different in Oregon. We certainly do. Montana solved this problem very, very simply, and we have just added more and more rules to it and to the solution. I don't think we need those rules. Thank you.
Mr. Duran.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Dwayne Doran. I'm the volunteer president of the Coalition for Oregon River Rights. First of all, I would like to applaud Senator Farioli and Senator Brown for raising the level of awareness to this issue. It's something that's gone on for far too long, and it's about time that we brought this thing to a successful resolution. That said, it's certainly no simple matter to get all of the people that surround the situation to come together. And we've taken a lot of time, met with people all over the state, with district attorneys, with judges, the county commissioners, landowners, and you get such polarized opinions on what people's rights are that it's you come to a belief after a while that there's no way that this can ever be solved. I mean, it's just it seems like a daunting task, but this is the right step. I think we're going in the right direction. I do not believe that this bill in its current form is the solution. I believe, I'm not going to reiterate all the things that the steelheaders just addressed, but one of the things that I just heard in the two prior testimonies from legislative counsel and from the Department of Justice seemed to conflict with one another. I believe I heard the Department of Justice indicate, via the AG's opinion, that we can't restrict the public's rights on waterways that would be deemed to be navigable, whether or not they're declared or not. But I see provisions in this bill that, without question, and according to legislative counsel's testimony, certainly restrict those rights. And that needs to be seriously looked at. The other issue is the non-motorized registration. This situation needs to be resolved first and foremost. It needs to be a multi-step plan, and as the steelheaders alluded to, I think a lot of people down the road would support some type of funding mechanism. But at this point in time, we have an issue that is absolutely unclear to everyone, and we don't know if the issue can be resolved by clarifying it. If the public knows where they need to be and the landowners understand what they can do, that may solve the problem and there might not be a need for creating a huge bureaucracy, which is what we see with this bill right now. So we would urge that that is seriously looked at and hopefully modified to where somewhere at some point down the road it could be implemented if necessary. And I like the idea of a committee that they just discussed to oversee how this whole process would work and move forward.
Questions from the committee? Thank you. I appreciate it very much. It sounds...
Thank you, sir.
Did you want?
I said, do you want me to go ahead?
No. Thank you, gentlemen. It sounds like, at least to me, that in its current form was a recurrent thing. This is the first hearing on this bill. Leslie Pittman, Tom Lindstrom, Mimi Stout. You may begin.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Pittman, and I'm the president of Operation Rivers, Northwest Oregon. Our mission is to achieve workable solutions to public river use while protecting private property rights and preserving riparian areas. We oppose Senate Bill 1028 for a multitude of reasons. It will create, rather than resolve, conflicts between recreationists and landowners. The health of our waterways will suffer as a result, and it does not clarify the rights along the waterways. Just because a river is floatable does not mean it's navigable. This bill is ignoring the intent of the law and consideration of all the factors comprising navigability. It may be heard that the AG's opinion supports Senate Bill 1028. However, I encourage reading the 12 Oregon court cases that comprise the public use doctrine because they clearly show four types of navigability: the obvious navigability of the ebb and flow of tide, obvious non-navigability of very small streams that are too shallow, too small, and are wholly private. But there is a third type of navigability that is navigability for boats and vessels to float upon the waters. It is clearly stated in the precedent that the title to the beds and the banks remains within the adjacent landowner. So here we have a navigability for a use, but not for the title of the land. The last navigability, of course, is on our large rivers that are susceptible to a great deal of commerce and remain within the state's hands for the public trust. I'd like to also add that the opinion of pleasure boat use came from a case on a lake or a lagoon and not on streams. The same case further clarified that it is not sufficient for navigability determinations where rowboats, small skiffs, or where hunters or fishermen pass over the water in boats used for that purpose. Senate Bill 1028 is assuming navigability on all streams that are floatable. As the court cases have ruled, this is not correct, and any uses beyond staying in a boat could be a Measure 37 claim and also a constitutional claim. I also wanted to inform you of our county's response 2 years ago to the Division of State Lands Management Plan. We had over 350 people turn out, and all but one were opposed to the state's management plan. However, everybody in the room supported a stay-in-your-boat floatability type plan. We're here to say that there is a better approach, the Local Solutions Floatage Plan. What we're proposing to do is create a section-by-section map by looking at each river individually and creating the map to show the appropriate uses based upon public and private ownership as well as sensitive riparian areas. It allows us to work with property owners and fishery enhancement teams using documentation to consider the condition of the rivers. It creates signage along the river so that folks would know what uses are appropriate and where. It allows for grant writing to provide for more restroom facilities and garbage containers. It would also allow for cleanup along the public accessible lands. We can work with landowners to provide more access, and we can monitor and measure the results with questionnaires. The Local Solutions Floating Plan is the answer that we need. It will limit the impact of the people without limiting the number of people. It puts the health of our waterways first. It does not require a bureaucracy, and there would be no fees and no permits. With our project already beginning on the Trask River, we are asking to be a model for other interested communities across Oregon. We're simply asking that this divisiveness of the ownership issue and all this conflict be put on hold to give local solutions a chance. One size does not fit all. We ask for your consideration to kill Senate Bill 1028. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Ms. Stout.
Senator Farioli and members of the committee.
Well, Ms. Stout, could I ask you to move the microphone?
Oh.
Thank you.
I'm Mimi Stout, and I'm a member, board member of the Alsea Valley Alliance that for almost 20 years has worked on the protection of the Alsea River and its fish and wildlife and riparian lands. I live at 19660 Alsea Highway in Alsea, Oregon, and my husband and I own the historic Hayden Ranch on the North Fork of the Alsea River. One of our goals in life is to keep this property, and especially the riparian lands, in good shape. It has not been easy. We have had our fences cut, our cattle let out on the highway causing an accident, our sheep killed by fishermen's dogs, our crops trampled, and trash and human waste deposited. Because we own the riverbanks, we have been able to institute some control over the situation. We now allow fishing by those who obey the game laws and treat the river and its adjoining lands with respect. In one area, though, we do allow unrestricted access to the public. And there, just recently, some fishermen who wanted better access to the river cut down willows and hardwoods that were planted to stabilize the riverbank and provide better fish habitat. We were therefore upset to learn of the Attorney General's opinion giving opening up the riverbanks to the public before a determination was made on their status of navigability, and to learn that the legislature was crafting bills that did the same. The state of Oregon has claimed the navigable rivers that were given to it by the federal government in 1859. Senate Bill 1028 changes navigable to floatable, which is really not the same. Navigable is a term defined by the federal government and requires a study of the stream or body of water before it is so declared. But the floatable designation is just blanket coverage by the state. The definition of floatable is rather vague. For instance, what is a boat? Some floating conveyances are not much more than glorified inner tubes. How deep is deep enough to be floatable? What is successful progress through a waterway? Does this mean that if one needs to spend a good deal of time walking and pulling their plastic raft behind them, that this is successful progress? Does any time mean during high water and low water, or does it mean only in either high water or low water? This bill is just a formula for conflicts because landowners on the smaller streams will think their portion of the river is not floatable, but the people who want to recreate on the riverbank will be of the opinion that it is floatable. Allowing the public to float down a river is reasonable and complies with federal and state law. However, letting people bank fish, picnic, hike, and hunt is not, especially if the river hasn't been proven to be navigable. For many people, the river is their backyard. How would the average citizen feel to go out in their backyard and see some strangers having a picnic? Or worse yet, have someone blast away with a gun? This bill also ignores the fact that some people do own the riverbeds. Our property was patented by the federal government to the original owners at least 2 years before Oregon became a state. Our deeds read to the middle of the river, or in one case, all of the river, and we have paid taxes on this land for over 35 years. There must be others that are in the same circumstances as we are. And my suggestion is that there should be a clause in this bill that says, on privately owned streams, those patented before Oregon became a state, the public can float their boats but not use the riverbanks except in emergency. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Walt, Barnman, Lawrence Edwards, and Mike Myrick. Welcome. Begin when you wish.
I'm Walt Bannon, and I represent the Northwest Rafters Association, and I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee here and the members. And the Northwest Rafters is a group of about 200-plus self-outfitted rafters and kayakers from around the state. We pretty much do our own trips and without using outfitters, and we run rivers from large ones to small ones, and having just been outside to feed the meter, I believe you could float out on the street the way it's raining, so it might even meet the floatability clause. I would say that we are strongly opposed to the Senate bill. We believe the navigability issue has already been spoken to by the Attorney General, and this bill somewhat redundant. We certainly would agree with much of what the Northwest Steelheaders have said and others. We would have a question about why, if this bill were to pass, why the advisory board would only have two recreational user members when this directly affects so much of the recreational community, and yet there are four landowner members. That doesn't seem equitable. The fees definitely create some hardships. My wife and I have boated since 1970. We own four rafts, two kayaks, and two fishing pontoon boats, a total of eight. To have to go through the fee structure that's set up in this bill would be a nightmare, not to mention the fact that we are almost always using two boats individually and occasionally loan another boat out to other friends or family members. So the structure doesn't work very well. What would happen with out-of-state boaters coming into the state? Would they have to apply for numbers and register their boats? A lot of us travel to Idaho, Washington, California, and those folks also come to Oregon, and a lot of tourist dollars could be impacted. Again, as self-outfitted rafters, we're using unimproved access points very frequently. Where this money goes is certainly an issue to us, in that we don't need fancy facilities and fancy boat ramps, and so we're not interested in having a lot of funding go toward that. And actually, we'd prefer that a lot of the access stay unimproved, would be our preference. We strongly take exception to the Metolius River being included in the bill, as and that's a river that we run, while not frequently, but several of our members run it every year, and we've even had club meetings over there in that area and have run the river as part of the festival. And our group is dedicated to educating folks that get into the rafting and kayaking and how to be good stewards of the land, and so clubs like us are very proactive in being sure that when we run a river, we're going to take good care of it and respect any landowner's rights. And having been a riverfront owner for 25 years on the North Umpqua River in Roseburg, we frequently had people stopping down below, as the last lady testified, but many of those people arrived via inner tubes, which I don't believe would be affected by this and this bill. And again, we have people floating on boogie boards and other craft that are can run a river that are, again, would be exempted under this bill. So the type of craft, again, is very confusing and a real hardship. So our group would be very much in opposition, and we hope this bill will be defeated. Thank you.
Mr. Edwards.
Lawrence Edwards. I live at 1112 Madison Street, Silverton, Oregon. You know, I'm greatly disturbed that the legislature is even considering a bill like 1028 and its mandatory creation of a new statewide bureaucracy and the imposition of a tax on a public highway. It's really interesting that this issue was a well-settled issue in the state of Oregon from 1856 until 1973. And in 1973, the Oregon legislature chose to make an absolute mess of it. Literally, many people labor under the false belief that Oregon has never recognized its ownership of the navigable waterways, and that is simply not true. They also believe that this is a relatively new crisis. It is not. The public's right to use Oregon waterways as public highways without any tax for the privilege of doing so was a well-settled issue, as I stated earlier. And surprisingly, at one time, the Oregon State Legislature declared almost every river and stream in the state of Oregon a part of our public highway system. None of those declarations, by the way, have ever been overturned in a court of law. What we find is that groups like the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, the Oregon Farm Bureau, instigated this mess that we have when in 1973 they successfully lobbied the Legislative Agriculture Committee to quietly repeal the law that protected the public's right to use our streams as highways. In 1856, the Territory Assembly passed legislation that granted to each county the authority to declare streams navigable if they had a practical use for commerce. That pre-statehood law was upheld by the Congress of the United States of America. And those early declarations withstood many state Supreme Court challenges as well. Consequently, any such declaration would be more than likely to hold up in court even today. In 1857, for example, the Legislative Territorial Assembly declared the Santiam and the North Santiam Rivers public highways. What's ironic is we now see those rivers listed as needing a navigability study, and yet they still remain, under Oregon law, public highways. Now, why on earth do we need a navigability study for a public highway? It makes no sense. Now, the Oregon State Supreme Court addressed this issue early on. And in 1886, they ruled, quote, if a freshwater stream is capable of serving an important public use as a channel of commerce, it should be considered public. They expanded on this in 1888 when they ruled, we are committed to the doctrine that a stream of water which is of sufficient extent and capacity to float logs and timber from mountainous regions to market and can be utilized thereby for the benefit and advantage of the community at large, notwithstanding it is included within the land owned by private individuals, is nevertheless a public navigable stream for such purposes, and we must accept that doctrine as law. Those early court decisions remain unchanged and unchallenged today. We know for a fact that the early Oregon legislature recognized that all navigable waters within the state were valuable and important resources that were critical for the economic development of this state. We know for a fact that the Oregon Supreme Court has consistently and in numerous cases upheld the notion that, yes, rivers and streams of consequence in Oregon are public highways and the public has a right to use them as long as they stay below the high water line. And we know for a fact that according to Oregon Admissions Act, the state of Oregon has no legal authority to charge tax or use of a waterway as a public highway. Now, if you really want to fix this mess, may I suggest that you just reinstate the laws that the legislature overturned in 1957 and again in 1973. Section 113.1405 of the 1940 Code states, quote, all navigable waters in this state shall be deemed public highways, and said franchise holder shall be declared a common carrier for the purposes of the Act, and the improvement of such streams, sloughs, and waters shall be deemed and declared a public use and benefit. And by the way, you will find that language in the Article 1, Section 18 of the Oregon State Constitution. And Section 113.1406 codifies the test of navigability that was handed down by the Oregon State Supreme Court and reaffirmed in the 1907 Canby-Norman's decision that states, any stream or its tributaries and in the state upon which logs or other forest products can be floated during certain periods of the year, with or without the use of splash dam, save and except Oswego Lake, is hereby declared to be a navigable stream and subject to the granting of a franchise to a person as provided in this Act. These laws go on to create an elaborate system by which the state actually leased stream beds throughout the state of Oregon.
Mr. Mayor, can I ask you to summarize your testimony?
In summary, I think that what we really need to do is look to history and say, let's just reinstate what we did. The laws were simple, they were straightforward, and they granted the public access to the public highways, which these streams are, and they granted the landowners the ability to maintain title to the land. And by the way, the Supreme Court in 1940 ruled that once you declare a stream navigable, and legislators do have the authority to do that, that designation cannot be undone. You simply can't unravel what was done. And I believe this would hold up in a court.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, I've tried to limit the... I'm sorry, Mr. Edwards.
Yeah.
I've tried to limit
folks'
testimony to 3 minutes. Did you submit your testimony in writing?
I will, yes.
Thank you. And we'll make sure that copies are distributed to all the members. I'm sorry, Mr. Meyer, I was misidentifying you. You're on, sir.
That's okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for hearing my testimony and testimony of others. My name is Mike Myrick, and I am a member of the Sandy River chapter of the Northwest Steelheaders. I spent a great deal of time volunteering on the Sandy and other rivers on many projects, cleanup targeting wild steelhead. I don't believe that we need more money, millions of dollars, as this would bring in. I think what we need is clarification of the law on this subject. When we do our cleanups on the river, we use drift boats, rafts, canoes, kayaks. Myself, I don't use my canoe on anything but a lake, but I can take it out in the pools of the Sandy. I don't think that I should have to be punished to go out and do volunteer work. We target wild steelhead under the auspices of state police and ODFW. Myself and two other members in the chapter spent numerous hours building transport boxes to take these steelhead to ODFW pickup points so they can get the eggs that's greatly needed for this project. We would have to get registration and pay out money for these. Some of our guys do not use these on the rivers. They use them only on lakes, and that would be a punishment. And I just do not believe that this would be a good thing for the state to start charging us to do volunteer work for the state. So I'm greatly opposed to this. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony.
Thank you. Neil Cowan. Ted McNeil, or McNeely, excuse me, and Brian Redd. Sandra Johnson. Please begin. Sandra, it looks like you're first.
I'm Ted McNeely, Myrtle Point, Oregon. I'm a timberland owner and cattle rancher. Me and my family own and manage several thousand acres in Coos and Curry County. We also have several miles of streams that would be affected under this. I've heard it mentioned several times as a compromise, and I can't see where there's any compromise here. I think that our rights would be just as well preserved under a navigability test. The only privilege we have under this bill would be to pay the taxes on the land. I'm hoping that you're just going to throw this 1028 out the window and forget about it, because it would take hours to go through this thing to point out the discrepancies. In fact, I didn't even know until today that a boat had to be associated with this, because the way it's written, it says any stream that's floatable or natural. It doesn't say it has to pass both tests. The way it's written, it only has to pass one test. If it would be natural, it would be open to the public. That could be any stream that doesn't dry up under the definition of a Class 1 waterway. So, and there are just multiple things in here that are just so unclear. They're not defined. And, you know, I'm troubled by these government agencies and their definitions and their opinions. And I just... looking at for instance, the John Day navigability recommendation, they misquote the judge's decision. I mean, that's just a short time ago. None of us have forgotten what the judge said about floatability. He said it is only as necessary for travel. Hunting and fishing will therefore not be allowed. But when the State Division or Division of State Lands makes their recommendation in their navigability report, they leave out the part for travel. It just, and I'm sure it's intended and it's calculated. And next year they'll be repeating their own document, and that what the judge said will long be forgotten. They go into this Gilliams, you know, and I'm just looking at a thing here that was addressed to you, sir, Ted Fiorelli, back in 1998 on this Gilliams case. And one of the things that the court said back then is that they could navigate the stream to the practical limit, but not to land at any point on Gilliam's land. So that's the Attorney General's opinion back in 98. Now here we are 7 years later, and we've got a whole different spin on the same case from a different Attorney General. It also specified, and you may remember this, that this is part of what the court said. It is in accord with sound public policy that each riparian owner shall have the right to fence his portion of the stream and to say to those above and below him, this body of water is mine. Thus far thou shalt go and no further. So those are just two quotes from the highly touted Gilliam case that the Attorney General is now relying on. I guess now, if it's clarified that they don't mean a natural stream, that it has to be floatable, that takes care of the boat thing. The damage and repair, I can just imagine what someone is going to do after they come on their property to either access or repair their boat or have their emergency. I'm sure that anyone anywhere on my property is going to have an emergency. And it doesn't even restrict how they're going to access. Are they going to access in a four-wheel drive vehicle or a motorcycle or, you know what? And then repair the damage? Can you imagine that? Out there trying to repair the damage they've done on my property? That's just a ridiculous thing. And then the definitions, for instance, I've heard it mentioned before, the floatability definition. The courts have said that streams are not navigable, and they're not floatable. But according to this, you could just grab yourself a rubber raft and hook it on your belt and head right down somebody's field or up their little creek, or if it's dry, it doesn't matter. They could go, and this hunting thing would be completely out of control if they were allowed to float down there and hunt waterfowl. I know, for instance, I have a lot of waterfowl that I introduced on my property when they were little babies years ago, and their offspring are still there. Now, I can control that now, but under this thing, people would have the right to hook a little boat on their belt and head down the strip river and shoot my ducks. I mean, how could you? I can just think of all kinds. I'm familiar with a lot of streams in the eastern Oregon, the Powder River and the Keating Valley, and small little streams where the ranchers own the whole stream for miles and miles and miles. It's always been private access. I could just imagine what a group of slob hunters could do now under this bill. Anyway, I guess that's probably used up my time. Thanks.
Thank you.
Sandra, or, yeah, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Sandra Johnson, a riverfront property owner, and I have been in the position with a lot of others where I've been threatened and have livestock killed, fences cut, etc. But my main concern today is not that. Nobody's mentioned the pollution of the rivers. Nobody's mentioned what was really intended when the federal government granted Oregon the right to the navigable rivers. I don't think they meant just open it to the public for recreation whenever and wherever. I think that they intended that the state manage the rivers for the interest of the public now and on into the future. When Oregon was a state, became a state, the population was 52,465. The 2000 census shows the population at 3,421,399. Oregon has an area of 98,000 square miles. And almost half of this is publicly owned already, which gives the public almost half the state to recreate in. And on the rivers, I think, excuse me, the state has 57,000 miles of rivers in it and 18,000 lakes. And of those 50,000 miles of river, the EQ studied 25,000 miles of rivers and 58 lakes. And of the 25,000 miles they studied, 15,000 were listed as impaired, or polluted, in other words. And 36 lakes were also listed as impaired. They haven't studied all of them. Also, you need to consider the rivers of the state of Oregon, or the waters, are the main drinking source for the population. In Salem, if you drink water, you're drinking the Santiam River water. just an Ann River kid. I don't know how polluted you want it to get. I know how polluted I don't want it to get. And I think the preserving the water quality is more important than a person's right to recreate. That's a decision the state has to make. Also, they have to make the decision to protect the fish and wildlife. I think they have an obligation for both. And I'm trying to get through and shorten this a bit. The fish runs have been steadily declining. Fish and wildlife in their 2005 fishing regulations has printed a fish advisory for the dangers of eating too much fish because of the mercury poisoning, mainly mercury, but PCBs and pesticides and dioxin. And yet we want to pollute the rivers more, put more people in them to pollute them more? I don't think so. I don't think this bill addresses any of those problems. I don't think the bill addresses the problem of the people walking in and causing problems. They're the biggest, in our river, they're the biggest cause of problems. The boaters just float down where they can and pull their boats. The people that walk in, dragging their kegs with them, and after they get drunk, just tear things up and threaten you and kill your livestock and et cetera. That's where my problem comes in. You don't, you want to put a fee on the boaters and the rafters, but you either need to put the fee on everybody that uses it or nobody, because that's discrimination. And then what's the state going to do? I mean, you're allowing a special group, which is river users, recreationists, and fishers, to have access to private property so they can recreate. Now, is the state going to allow the hunters to have access to all the private property because the state owns a deer and an elk so they can recreate or hunt? Is that going to be next? Are they going to take more of our rights away? And I couldn't find any reference for the right of a person to recreate where and when they want it. I don't agree with this bill, and I don't know about the other bills yet that are before. I didn't get this in time to do justice to my research, but we will, myself and other property owners, will be responding, and we have written testimony to give to you. And thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Redd?
Chairman, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Brian Redd. I'm here on behalf of myself, my wife, and my 14-year-old daughter, all of whom fish and use Oregon's rivers. I am not here representing anyone else. We are not members of any organization or club that's involved in or has taken a position on this issue. Prior to being a businessman, which I am today, my career was as a lawyer. And during that time in which I served with the U.S. Department of Justice and then in private practice as a partner in a large law firm, I worked on navigability and river use issues. So I understand the legal, social, and political issues involved. I've studied Senate Bill 1028, and I oppose it strongly. SB 1028 does not codify or even attempt to define our rights to use our rivers. There is nothing whatsoever in the bill that tells us what our rights will be under this new legislation. The bill inexplicably delegates that most critical function to the State Land Board, who may then delegate it to other state agencies or even to local governments. Not until these new regulations are issued by the Land Board or perhaps other state agencies or local governments will we then know what our new rights are. SB 1028 gives us no assurances whatsoever that these new regulations will give us the same rights we currently have under existing law. Today, we know what our rights are. The Attorney General's opinion describes them and confirms them. Our current rights are not new. The Attorney General didn't make them up. They've existed for many, many years. They're not ambiguous. Indeed, they're quite clear. This is not new law. It's not some scheme to take property away from people. It has been this way always. Indeed, it's the very foundation upon which Oregon became a state, just like other states. Senate Bill 1028, however, wipes those rights away, and it creates a clean slate. And the new regulations will define what goes on that slate, what our new rights will be. Yes, those new rights may look just like the ones we have today, but I doubt it. They may be much more restricted, and they may limit public access and recreational uses. I certainly understand and concur with the concern of riparian landowners regarding damage to their property from irresponsible river users. And although generally I have an aversion to administrative fees, I would support a reasonable fee structure if those fees were primarily targeted to A, education of river users, and B, education of landowners, and enforcement of existing laws. I wonder, however, whether all that we hear about damage to the property of riparian landowners is the real issue here. Or is that mostly a justification for restricting the public's rights and replacing them with private rights, converting public use rivers to private rivers? 20 years ago, when Montana enacted its stream access law, it established a fund to be used to compensate landowners who might incur property damage from irresponsible river users. Last time I checked, not a single claim for damages has ever been filed in those 20 years. So I question whether property damage is really what this is all about. We cannot give up over 100 years of public use, a cornerstone upon which the state was built, so riparian landowners can have their own private rivers and exclude us all. Unfortunately, Senate Bill 1028 starts us down that path. In addition to the fact that SB 1028 wipes out our existing rights without telling us what our new rights will look like, here are some other additional flaws.
Mr. Redd, you're up against your 3 minutes. Did you produce the testimony in writing?
I did, Senator.
And would you submit it for the record, please?
May I make one closing comment?
Absolutely.
With all due respect to Legislative Council and his answer to Senator Ringo's question of what effect does 1028 have on rivers that have been deemed navigable, I think the answer he gave is only partially correct. Specifically, in section 4, subparagraph 5, that specifically says for those rivers where navigability has been determined, specific uses are delineated as not being preempted. But those are just building open fires, overnight camping, etc. The fundamental uses of rivers are, in fact, not covered in subparagraph 5, which means that even in those cases where there's been a navigability determination, the management plan can change existing uses. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And if I could ask a question to Mr. Redd?
Certainly.
Thanks for coming today. First of all, I want to make sure you submitted your written testimony, so I've got on the stack somewhere.
You probably don't have it yet. Okay. I have copies of it with me.
Okay, well, if you could make sure to get it to the administrator.
Yeah,
my question to you is, navigability is set forth in the Admissions Act, and that gives rights to Oregon citizens. Do you believe that if Senate Bill 1028 restricts the rights beyond what citizens would otherwise have under the Admissions Act, would the bill be subject to constitutional challenge?
It's a serious question, Senator. I would expect those challenges would be raised. And certainly in terms of the federal rights, I don't have the answer to that. I think it is a serious legal question that I haven't seen addressed adequately.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming here.
Thank you. Susan Davenport, Les Helgeson, Larry Beaver.
Senator, may I pass my position to Mr. Milbourne, please?
Mr. Milbourne is on the. Is he signed up on the list?
Yes, but he's got here late. He had traffic problems.
Mr. Milbourne, please. And is that in lieu of your testimony,
yes,
Mr. Beaver?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Milbourne, please. And Susan Davenport, not present.
Mr. Koenigsegg, I'm probably butchering your name. K-O-E-N-I-G-S-K-N-E-C-H-T. Please come forward.
I didn't find that speaking.
You signed up.
I'm sorry.
You saved the committee 3 minutes. Thank you, sir. Dale Johnson. Mr. Helgeson, you're up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Farioli, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Les Helgeson. I live on the upper Nestucca River, and I've had about 20 years experience with this issue. And you've probably seen some of my written communication previously. I'm sure that's part of the record. I'm very concerned about Senate Bill 1028 because it's oversimplifying a very complicated issue. And I think you're hearing today virtually everybody's opposing this for one reason or another, and it is a complex issue. And I was instrumental, along with my neighbors and other folks, in implementing the navigability study process many years ago now, because the state was attempting to take a one-size-fits-all approach to navigability and public access. And I think we worked with a number of attorneys, and there were different attorneys working then for the Department of Justice, and it's not uncommon for attorneys to have different opinions, of course. They get paid to argue different opinions. So we arrived at this as being the best solution after extensive study, a lot of money, a lot of discussion with attorneys, knowledgeable folks, that a one-size-fits-all approach does not. It just wasn't flying. Problems were worse then than they are now. And I can appreciate Treasurer Edwards' impatience and desire to resolve this issue, but it's not going to happen. And it's not going to happen with any legislation, and particularly this legislation. I really like the idea that Gary Benson mentioned earlier of forming an interim committee to deal with this very complex issue. We're not going to, by the end of the session, we're not going to digest the AG's opinion and all the other complexities surrounding this issue. So maybe we could arrive at some consensus at that point, maybe not. But there are a number of complexities we brought up many years ago, such as the condition of the rivers at statehood. Currently, NOAA Fisheries and Department of Fish and Wildlife tell us we're greatly deficient in woody debris in our streams. Consequently, at statehood, prior to the fires, prior to the clean out of the rivers in the 70s, there were a lot of log jams. The rivers were generally much less navigable than they are today. That's just one of many issues you've got to deal with. They're going to be different on the John Day than they are on the coastal streams. So we just, it's a tough call here, and I cannot support this bill, especially given the financial resources and time and energy we put into getting the study process in place. I've discussed this with the governor as well, and I think generally the idea of an interim committee is being received pretty well, and I'd like look forward to working with that. And I think perhaps it's the study process itself needs to be tweaked, or maybe it's the governor's call or the land board's call. How could we increase the efficiency of that process? I wish I had an answer today, and with that I'll close my remarks and thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Helgeson. Mr. Johnson?
Yes, I'm Dale Johnson, a property owner on the Little North Fork of the San Yam. I can't add too much in opposition to the bill than what I've already heard here, some very good arguments. I just would ask you to, we've had this problem for hundreds of years, so ask you not to act in haste to try and solve it this month. That's all I have.
And Mr. Johnson, you're in opposition to the bill as a landowner. Is that... Can you tell me what is the source of your opposition?
Well, we own the property, Bed and Banks, now, and we feel that allowing the public to use it would be usurping our property rights. And what will I do with my dogs? They're loose on the property. Do I have to keep them chained up so they don't bother the swimmers and the fishermen? That's what objection I have to it.
Thank you. Sir?
Chairman Feraldi, my name for the record is Chapin Milbank, and I'm a resident of Salem. I've been an attorney since 1960. I've been interested in this issue for a number of years. I recently defended a duck hunter in Klamath Falls, who unfortunately lost his case down there, but is now in the Court of Appeals, and we're so confident in winning that I think the Attorney General will simply agree with that we are right. The whole thrust of my written argument, I won't repeat it all, is that Oregon has, of course, as all the states that got admitted after the original 13 states, the public trust doctrine. And I've not heard the word trust yet here this afternoon. And what trust means is that the state holds these rivers in trust for the people. You have literally a fiduciary relationship to make sure these rivers are usable by all of the people in the state of Oregon. This is a terrible bill, and I've spent five pages going through it, and I agree with Gary Benson when he says the part about the Natolius River just sticks in your craw, and it just symbolizes everything that's wrong with this bill, which is it's the landowner versus the fisherman. Now, I own land on the north fork of the Santa Ana River.
And I've owned for a number of years. I observe river users from my property, and without question, they have been courteous. They have been enjoying their time. They've been having a great time. They've never trashed my property. Conversely, when I go down the Santa Ana River and get to the little town of Jefferson and pull out at the Greens Bridge ramp, I discover what we now famously call as the Greens Bridge Jefferson City Adjunct Dump. We are the little group of people that I belong to, and you'll find a lot of boaters and people coalesce into informal groups. We assess ourselves one weekend a year. That is to say, we take it every week of the year, and we go down with pickup trucks, and we haul the trash out of there. Toilets, mattresses, barn shingles, barn ventilators, roofing paper. None of these items I've ever seen in a drift boat or in a rubber boat or in a kayak or even in somebody's tackle box. So, you know, if you want to have a tax on somebody, and that's what this bill is a tax bill, let's be fair. Let's tax the guy who lives along the river as well as the guy who uses the river. The interim committee study is probably okay, although this is a huge problem. But I think the overwhelming argument against this bill is that it's a violation of the Oregon Public Trust. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Milbank. And Mr. Milbank, you had signed up with Ted to testify.
I did, yeah.
Thank you.
First name is Chap. See
you. Got it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Katie Fast. James Pittman. And Jenny Bricker.
Good afternoon or good evening, Chair Ferrioli and Senator Ringo. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Oregon Farm Bureau has invested a great deal of time and effort in working with stakeholders and land board members for a solution to the navigability issue. Unfortunately, we cannot support 1028 or the Dash 1 amendments. This legislation goes beyond navigability and grants access to private property along the majority of Oregon's streams and rivers. The floatage definition does not require passage to allow access. These are truly not navigable rivers entirely. We are also concerned about fencing that's along the streams and may cross streams. Does this fencing need to be removed, along with irrigation equipment concerns for liability as well? Currently, there are 7 rivers being petitioned for navigability studies. And in this navigability process, there is an individual assessment of the merits of each of these rivers and the opportunity for public comment. A blanket statewide access bill does not include either. We also have concerns about the portage provision in this in the legislation. It gives additional access beyond the beds and banks, and the language, the most direct access, is very vague. And even though the legislation states that a person is liable for damage, it's very hard to track a person conducting damage unless the landowner is there and present to view the damage being done. There's additional concerns with the Dash 1 amendments that irrigation canals and drainage ditches fall under the definition of a Class 2 waterway, and the public could be granted access by the adjacent landowners. The irrigation districts are concerned about liability issues this brings, and there are unique safety issues that are unique from natural waterways. Farm Bureau is interested in working with the legislature or with the land board on discussions of pilot projects for rivers to see how we can solve conflicts before we push an untested statewide process on landowners. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Bricker.
Senator Farioli, good afternoon. My name is Jenny Bricker. I'm an attorney at Stoll Reeves LLP in Portland, Oregon, and I'm here today representing House on the Metolius and its owner, Mr. Kim Lundgren. The Lundgren family has owned property on the Metolius since the early 1900s, and since then has been a leader in the conservation and preservation of what is really an extraordinary waterway. The Metolius River is unique, even among Oregon's many unique and beautiful streams and rivers and lakes, and it is also uniquely vulnerable to overuse. The Metolius is managed as a wild and scenic river. Portions of the river have been already closed to boating because boat passage is either entirely obstructed by logs and woody debris, which preserve the river in its natural state and provide fish habitat, or that it's obstructed enough to make boating very dangerous in those stretches. On most of the river, including the headwaters, recreational users of the river and its banks have access from federal or other public lands. House on the Metolius supports Senate Bill 1028 as introduced, including the definition of the Metolius River as a Class 2 waterway. We also support the general framework of Senate Bill 1028, including the use of rulemaking and the creation of a management plan and the appointment of a waterways advisory committee to work out the details of the public's right to use floatable or Class 1 waterways. I think it sounds like an approach that has the flexibility that could actually work, and then I think the devil would be in the details. We do have concerns, which I'll mention, about how the scope of public use is defined as the bill. And I'll just give you a caveat that I didn't see the Dash 1 amendments until today, so my comments are restricted to the bill as it was introduced. Recreational use is defined in the bill as participation in water-dependent activities and incidental uses connected with those activities. As written, this definition is overly broad. Taken with the other language in the bill, it suggests that recreational use could include activities not connected to the use of a boat. However, there is nothing in current Oregon case law to indicate that the public has the right to the use of the banks of a waterway except as incidental to navigation or floating. In other words, there has to be a boat involved somehow. And I'll also mention that the bills I think the Legislative Council mentioned one of the great aspects of the bill in the non-motorized boat registration is the factor of accountability. Boat users would be accountable because they'd have a number plastered on the side of their boat or they'd have a permit that could be referenced. If you don't have a boat involved, of course, that kind of erodes that accountability element. The right of public use, or what people commonly refer to as the floated easement, is a creature of common law, and it was developed in a series of just a few Oregon cases, Weiss versus Smith in 1869, Shaw versus Oswego Iron Company in 1882, the Gilliams case in 1918, and Lusher versus Reynolds in 1936. The law is what it is. Since we're dealing with property, we have to measure the relative rights of the property owner, the riparian owner, against the rights of the public or the holder of the easement. Senate Bill 1028 cannot go beyond what the law now establishes, because if it does, if it attempts to enlarge the rights of the public, it will amount to a taking of the riparian owner's property rights. The opinion issued by Oregon Attorney General's office last month does not change Oregon law. I was struck by a remark that Ms. Bensel made that the opinion attempted to predict what a modern court would do. But what a modern court would do, or the AG's prediction of what a modern court would do, is not Oregon law. Oregon law is as it is right now. I have a couple of issues with the AG's opinion, if we have time. Page 24 of the opinion says that Gilliams and Lusher suggest that the permitted public uses, I'm quoting, include a broad range of activities involving the use of water.
Ms. Berker?
Yes.
Are you prepared to, or have you prepared a written testimony?
I have. Would you prefer to get this in writing?
Yes, I would. And just incidentally, because it may refer more in that section, at least, to the AG's opinion, and we're trying to complete the record on 1028.
If you'd
like to summarize.
Yes, I believe that my exceptions or my issues with the AG's opinion have to do with how that opinion defines the scope of the public use right. And I'll give that to you in writing. To the extent that the AG's opinion informs or supports 1028's broad definition of recreational use, I'd encourage you to take a look at these comments and ask yourselves if it really is that broad under the current law. Because essentially, we know just from general law of easements and property rights that the purpose of an easement is the thing that defines its scope. The purpose of the floatage easement is navigation, or the right to use floatable rivers and streams as highways. The essence of the floatage easement is transportation. Use of the banks is not included in the public's easement rights, except as that use might be incidental to boat navigation. And that's why I say, and the revisions that I suggest are to the point that a boat has to be involved in the public use.
I'll be interested in seeing those suggested revisions.
And in closing, I would just submit to you that I have a test in my own work for knowing when opposing parties have successfully negotiated a settlement agreement, and the test is that everybody hates it. So I'll submit to you that perhaps we're there.
We declare success and go home. Seems like we've achieved that objective. Thank you, ma'am. Sir, Mr. Pittman.
Thank you, Senator. My name's Jim Pittman. I'm a property owner on the Trask River in Tillamook. And basically, I'd urge all of you to oppose this bill because I frankly view it as an outright taking of my private property rights. And essentially, I don't know how well a Measure 37 claim would be upheld in court regarding this matter, but I have a feeling that there isn't enough room in this building to contain all the paperwork for the lawsuits submitted for that. And basically, as Treasurer Randles had asserted earlier, yes, navigability studies are a long, drawn-out, contentious, and expensive issue. However, when it comes to private property rights, as far as I understand at this time, the navigability study is the only legal course to determine the solution to this issue. And personally, I would rather lose my rights as a matter of due legal process rather than just having them given away by something along the lines of this bill. And frankly, I urge you oppose this and look into other potential solutions, as, for example, what's been proposed by Operation Rivers. Thank you.
Thank you. I asked the committee if it had any questions. That would be me. Mr. Wieprecht, Mr. Sackinger, and Heather McNeil, please come forward. Mark Wieprecht, Bruce Sackinger,
Shane Sampson? Michelle Sampson? And you have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Heather McNeil. I live in West Lynn. I'm opposed to 1028 for a lot of the reasons stated here about how complex the bill is in not establishing what our rights are now. Instead, it defers it to numerous committees throughout the state. I am a recreationalist, and I do believe in the public access to the rivers throughout the state. I do believe that those were put in trust for us for a lot of reasons beyond boating. That became very clear to me the other night while at a meeting. It was for a fishing club, and the reason had nothing to do with fishing. There in a slideshow was a picture that brought me back to my childhood. It was a picture of two boys jumping off a rock in the John Day River, wild with happiness. And that took me back to Coos County and all of the rivers there where I did such things. Traveled below the high water mark, picking blackberries with friends, inner tubing, doing other things, swimming. And my rights, I thought, as a child, had been clearly explained to me by my parents. You will never leave the bed of the river unless you know and have permission from the landowner to do so. You will only get into the river at public access or on somebody's land who you have access. It was really clear to myself and several other people that that's how we were supposed to do it. And that's what we did. Frequently moving from property to property, far down a river and coming out at a friend's house, miles downstream. The state has the authority to protect that trust for the children of the state. I do believe it serves an incredible value for all the people to have that available. As a recreationalist and a fisherman now, I continue to use it, and I am not wealthy enough to be a property owner, nor were my parents who were school teachers, and nor are many, many people of the state. But my life has changed, and for the better, because of public access to the rivers. I think any bill that gets written needs to be clear enough that our school children can understand it, so that after school they can ride their bikes to the river and not have to read through a myriad of paperwork to understand where they can come and go. The kids need to be able to carry their fishing bikes or their fishing rods on their bikes, just like last summer when I was up a creek just outside of Salem and saw two boys riding their bikes with their rods get in near a bridge and travel down the river. Far better the kids should be doing that after school than many, many of the other things that they could be doing. That's why 1028 is not good. We need something simple that's clear so that everyone can understand. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Your name, sir?
My name is Mark Weprecht. I am a property owner on a small stream. I opposed this bill. I think it's doesn't do justice to either the property owner or the recreational user, and I am also a recreational user and have been boating in Oregon for 53 out of my 56 years. I've been running the John Day for 35 years. My family has been running rivers in Oregon for 194 years. I think the bill should be scrapped completely and start over. I really think the issue will not be resolved until the U.S. Supreme Court deals with it, because I think either side will take it there. And frankly, the way I read the law, when I bought my property 19 years ago, my deed says I own to the middle of the stream. I was certainly aware at the time I bought my property what that meant, that anybody could float by, anybody had use of the river up to the high water mark, and anybody, I've talked to some landowners that they're not sure where the high water mark is. If they don't know where it is, they don't live on a river. They may own property on a river, but they don't live on a river. Because you certainly are very aware of that if you live on the river. There are many, many details in this bill that are but I could go on and on. Most of them have been covered, and I'll let those be. But I just, my strong opposition to this bill.
Thank you. We'll call once more Bruce Schachinger, S-C-H-I-N-G-E-R, and Shane and Michelle Sampson. Is there any other person here present that wishes to give testimony on the bill? Hearing and seeing none, this public hearing is closed. I want to, before I do that, sorry, stop. I want to thank you all for what I think is an extraordinary hearing. There's deep passions about river recreationist rights and landowners' rights, very evident. And the way in which the participants conducted themselves this evening here at this hearing is, I believe, a good reflection on Oregon citizens. Thank you for your courtesy to each other and to the committee. With that, the meeting is closed.